right. And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me here on this Spotlight. Senior analyst, foreign policy, and focus Ian Williams out of New York, and journalist and political analyst Elijah McNair out of Brussels. And we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Pahiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Mathadul ladhina yunfiquna amwalahum fi sabilillah. كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel launches airstrikes on the Gaza Strip amid tensions following the recent escape of several Palestinians from a high-security Israeli jail. A video analysis shows the U.S. military may have targeted an aid worker rather than Daesh terrorists in Afghanistan in an attack that killed 10 civilians. Also ahead, the U.S. government is under pressure to release an FBI report on the possible role of Saudi Arabia in the 9/11 attacks. Joining us. Our top story this hour, Israeli warplanes have once again targeted positions of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas in the besieged Gaza Strip. Israel claimed the attack was in response to rockets fired from Gaza. The airstrikes took place hours after Israeli forces arrested 2 of the 6 Palestinian inmates who escaped from the regime's high-security Gilboa prison earlier this week. Hamas has already condemned Israel's airstrikes on the Strip, saying they are in line with the regime's invasive policies. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassam added that the Zionist regime cannot stop Gaza and resistance groups from supporting the Palestinians in their fight for national issues. Israel says it has arrested 2 more Palestinian inmates who escaped the regime's Gilboa prison. That brings the number of recaptured prisoners to 4. Israeli forces said the escapees were captured in a truck parking lot on Saturday morning. 2 other Palestinian prisoners were detained near the city of Nazareth on Friday, but 2 others are still at large. Israel has been conducting a massive manhunt since Monday when 6 prisoners tunneled out of one of the regime's highest security prisons. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says the arrest signals a new round of explicit conflict with the occupying regime. Earlier, the Islamic Jihad movement also warned that putting the lives of the inmates in danger would be a declaration of war against Palestinians. Mona Kandil is our correspondent in the occupied territories and joins us now. Mona, welcome. What's the latest you're hearing on the ground there?
Well, last night, Israeli forces revealed they had arrested 2 Palestinians who succeeded to be out of the Gilboa prison last Monday, Mohammed Mahmoud Al-Arda and Qadri And in the early hours of Saturday, the Israeli military spread footage for two more Palestinians, Palestinian prisoners arrested by the Israeli forces as well. Zakaria Zubaydi, a former leader of the Fatah's armed wing, Al-Aqsa Brigades, as well as Muhammad Al-Arda, who's a member of the Jihad movement. The pictures that were circulated via the social media showing Zakaria Zubaydi and with the bruises on his face and his body, clarifying that it seems that the Israeli soldiers have attacked those two Palestinians when they arrested them. They were found in an area near Al-Afule in the northern Israel, and they were in very bad looking conditions according to these footages. Now, the Israeli military are trying to tell the Palestinians that the two who were arrested yesterday, they were in the city of Al-Nasira, and that they are claiming they were looking for food. And when some Palestinian family there refused to give them food, and they told the Israeli military that some people look suspicious, are walking in the streets of Al-Nasira. Palestinians today are saying we must not be dragged by these Israeli military statements. All the Palestinians are one, whether in the Gaza Strip, in the occupied West Bank, in Al-Quds, in the lands occupied in 1948, and they were really worried about those Palestinian prisoners. Now, we are still speaking about two other Palestinian prisoners. The Israeli military are still looking for them. However, maybe the next hours will be very difficult for the four Palestinians who had been arrested by the Israeli forces. They will face interrogation. They might be face different forms of humiliation and mistreatment in order to know all the details. How did they think and how did they succeed to be out of the Gilboa prison?
Right, indeed. And Mona, just finally, very quickly, we saw the Israel flooding its troops into the occupied Palestinian territories, the occupied West Bank. Is that heavy military presence still there in the West Bank?
Yes, that's right. Mainly the roads leading to the northern areas like Jenin, because at first the Israeli military said those Palestinian prisoners might succeed to enter Jenin, or that they succeeded to infiltrate into Jordan. However, up till the moment, it seems that they only reached Al-Nasira, northern the lands occupied by Israel in 1948. The operation is still going on with more checkpoints has been erected between the cities and the areas, because they are still looking for the last two who had get out from the Gilboa prison. And because the Israeli military said it was a slap in the face, this operation that was carried out last Monday, and that the only reaction would be in order to silence the Israeli street is to arrest all the prisoners who escaped from the Gilboa prison.
Right, indeed. Mona, thank you very much indeed for that. Mona Kandil there, our correspondent, joining us from Ramallah. Turning to other news now, Tehran has slammed Israel after the regime's foreign minister accused Iran of marching towards building a nuclear weapon. In a tweet, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said Israel is an outlaw regime sitting on illicit nukes and refusing to join the non-proliferation treaty. Said Khatibzadeh said the regime nonetheless keeps threatening Iran, which is a signatory to the NPT and has the world's most inspected nuclear program. He described the regime as a habitual extorter and the darling of the West. Khatibzadeh warned that Iran reserves the right to respond to Israel, referring to the regime's threat to act against Tehran to stop its nuclear program. International lawyer Edward Corrigan says it is blatantly hypocritical for Israel to call out Iran over its nuclear program.
But, you know, the whole thing is hypocritical. Israel clearly has nuclear weapons, maybe as many as 400. They're not a signatory to the non-proliferation treaty, and these, missiles and atomic weapons were obtained with the support of the French and then the Americans. Iran has not attacked a country in nearly 300 years. Israel has attacked its neighbors probably 300 times in the last, since its founding in 1947. So, there's, sheer hypocrisy and a double standard where that Israel is really the danger to the region. And while they're trying to use, Iran's nuclear program as an excuse, Israel keeps attacking Lebanon, keeps attacking Syria. It's, numerous attacks on Jordan, attacks on Egypt and other countries. And they've assassinated Iranian scientists and Iraqi scientists. So Israel clearly is the belligerent and is hypocritical in terms of the claims it's making. Israel really is the threat to the whole region and maybe to the world, not Iran.
Turning to the latest developments in Afghanistan, where a resistance commander has vowed that the fight against the Taliban will continue despite the fall of the last major opposition holdout. Saleh Rajasthani says resistance fighters in the Panjshir Valley will fight the Taliban to the death. He says the presence of the Taliban in Panjshir does not mean the fight has ended. Rather, it is just the beginning. The commander urged the international community not to recognize the Taliban rule. The mountainous region north of Kabul was captured by the Taliban last week. The group overran the Afghan capital in mid-August amid the withdrawal of US-led foreign forces. A new report has raised doubt on the US military account of targeting the alleged planner of a last month bomb attack in Afghanistan. The New York Times says it has conducted a video analysis that shows the suspect claimed to have been loading explosives into his car was actually handling water canisters. It also identifies the suspect as an aid worker. The report questions the US military account that claims explosives were present at the scene of the drone strike, which caused a second blast. The probe suggests 10 civilians, 7 of them children, lost their lives in the U.S. attack. That's compared to Washington's estimate of 3 civilian deaths. The U.S. said it was retaliating against the August 26 strike claimed by Daesh that killed over 180 people, including 13 American service members. The United States finally pulled its troops out of Afghanistan after nearly 2 decades of its occupation of the country. Washington invaded Afghanistan under the pretext of its so-called war on terror and establishing security there, but left behind a legacy of insecurity, conflict, and violence, as well as death and destruction.
The U.S. destroyed things everywhere in Afghanistan. They behaved badly not just in one place, but in all 34 Afghan provinces.
They didn't bring us peace and stability in the past 20 years.
In the past 20 years, the U.S. didn't do anything good for us. As a taxi driver, I didn't see them bring us any benefits.
Wherever they go, the U.S. will destroy the country and the resources there. They may spend millions of dollars to help Afghanistan, but the resources they got from Afghanistan are worth millions of dollars.
The U.S. came to our country 20 years ago. I think their original purpose was not to bring peace and stability, but for economic benefits in a very short time. The U.S. has some projects on Asia, especially Central Asia, so they came to Afghanistan. These projects are only for their own benefit instead of the welfare of the Afghan people.
The United Nations has appealed for an injection of cash into Afghanistan to avoid an economic meltdown.
We need to find ways to avoid a situation that would be catastrophic for the people and, in my opinion, a source of instability and an excellent gift for terrorist groups still operating there.
Antonio Guterres said he is in talks with the chief of the International Monetary Fund, adding it is essential to agree on waivers or mechanisms to get money into Afghanistan. The IMF has blocked the Taliban from accessing some $440 million in new emergency reserves. Guterres said the UN believes that dialogue with the Taliban is absolutely essential at the present moment. Meanwhile, the World Food Programme has warned that one-third of the population in Afghanistan faces acute food insecurity.
The surveys we were doing before the 15th of August indicated that 81% of households were not consuming sufficient food. After the 20th, up until the 5th of September, that number went up to 93%.
Anthea Webb stressed that malnutrition already affects one in two children under the age of five in Afghanistan. She said three out of four households are using extreme coping mechanisms, such as skipping meals or preferring to give food to children instead of adults. The agency's latest assessment says 15 of Afghanistan's 34 provinces have shown less food consumption in the past month. Now, families of the victims of the 9/11 attacks in the US are expecting their government to release an FBI report on the possible role of Saudi Arabia on the 20th anniversary of the attacks. The families are suing the Saudi government for its complicity in the attacks that killed nearly 3,000 people. The 16-page report is an analysis of the FBI's investigation into the activities of two Saudi hijackers. The report is expected to provide details on other Saudis who helped the pair in California in 2000. The family's lawyers believe they can prove that a group of Saudi officials had conspired with the two Al-Qaeda operatives. President Joe Biden ordered the release last week. This after victims' families said the U.S. president would not be welcome at anniversary memorials. Moscow has summoned Washington's ambassador over the alleged interference of U.S. tech giants in Russia's upcoming parliamentary election. According to Moscow, John Sullivan was summoned to meet Russia's deputy foreign minister, Sergei Ryabkov, over the alleged interference. The Russian Foreign Ministry says they have undeniable evidence that U.S.-based tech giants violated Russia's laws ahead of the election due later this month. It also condemned any interference in its internal affairs as absolutely unacceptable. Brings it into our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com www.ISIS.org/EN.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. Oh, the most merciful.
In the limelight.
The worst prison break in the Israeli regime's history is just the latest in a chain of events that demonstrate the fragility of the Israeli security apparatus and, indeed, the weakness of the colonial project as such. We'll prepare for you an article written by Denijal Yejik, a researcher and author, currently postdoctoral research fellow at the Lebanese American University in Beirut, Lebanon, where he teaches multimedia journalism and communication. The piece is titled Palestinian Prisoners' Liberation Shows Fragility of Colonial Regime. Six Palestinian political prisoners escaped from a high-security prison operated by the Israeli regime. Despite a meticulously organized network of colonial oppression, the Israeli regime is confronted with its own weakness, as the latest incident shows. The six Palestinian prisoners were facing life sentences in Israeli prisons. They escaped through an underground tunnel that they were able to dig from within the prison. Zionist regime's forces have launched a search operation. An Israeli official called the incident a major security and intelligence failure. Indeed, the high-security Gilboa prison in northern occupied Palestine has been described as the most intensely secured of its kind. The mere fact that the Palestinians were able to escape points to the fragility of Israel's colonial incarceration industry. For over a century, Zionist settlers have been inventing ways to grab the land and cleanse it of its indigenous population. Yet, they are constantly faced with the perseverance of the Palestinian resistance, a struggle that the colonial regime cannot win in the long run. Prisons in particular are an integral part of the Israeli colonial system and serve as a method of control, contain, and silencing of Palestinians. Thousands of Palestinians, including at least 200 Palestinian children, are currently incarcerated in Israeli jails. This year alone, around 1,000 Palestinian children have been arrested by the Israeli military. Palestinians from the occupied West Bank are locked up in prisons in the territories of 1948 in violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which forbids the occupying power from population transfer. The Israeli regime regularly abducts Palestinian children in the middle of the night. Prisoners are often subject to various forms of physical and emotional violence, including torture and sexual abuse. The Israeli regime's well-organized prison structure is an epitome of the power relations between the occupier and the indigenous population. Palestinian life, as such, is criminalized under colonial rule. Palestinians become suspects through their very existence and presence on their own land. The Israeli regime has imprisoned Palestinians for activities such as throwing stones or publishing poetry. Palestinian reality under Israeli rule is characterized not only by incarceration in jails. Through colonial techniques of segregation and surveillance, the Israeli regime has fragmented the West Bank into enclaves, separated by an abundance of walls, cages, and gates. This regime of terror largely stems from the colonizers' fear of the indigenous people and its attempts to control every aspect of Palestinian life and effectively coerce Palestinians into complete capitulation. The nuclear-armed Israeli regime is a regional occupying regime and child-killing entity that enjoys extraordinary protection by the United States and support from its Western backers. It plays a crucial role in the transnational industry of oppression, marketing itself as a successful model of colonial practices, military supremacy, surveillance, and spying technologies. But the many billions of U.S. taxpayer dollars that are being pumped into the Israeli regime could not prevent the six Palestinians from escaping Gilboa prison. Neither can Israel's propaganda machine or military wars obstruct Palestinians from fighting their continuous struggle for freedom and liberation. The worst prison outbreak in the Israeli regime's history is just the latest in a chain of events that demonstrate the fragility of the Israeli security apparatus and indeed the weakness of the colonial project itself. In May of 2021, following heightened Israeli attacks on Christian and Muslim worshippers on Easter and the holy month of Ramadan, repeated raids in the Al-Aqsa Mosque and an aggressive ethnic cleansing campaign in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of the occupied city of Al-Quds, the Israeli regime launched a bombardment campaign in the Gaza Strip. Palestinian resistance responded with significantly strengthened military capacity. The Israeli regime's Iron Dome defense system failed to intercept many of the rockets coming from the Gaza Strip, which were able to reach Al-Quds and Tel Aviv. Palestinians from the different parts of historic Palestine and the diaspora cooperated in their resistance efforts. Protests in solidarity with the Palestinian struggle erupted worldwide. The Israeli regime had to proclaim an embarrassing ceasefire and suffered a major public relations failure. The war displayed the increased capacities of the Palestinian resistance and showed how rapidly the Israeli regime was losing control of the situation. The events enforced a new equation. They also demonstrated the Israeli regime's existential dependence on foreign backing, particularly on its role as a proxy for the United States. Washington's declining significance in the region of West Asia may bear more unfavorable repercussions for the Tel Aviv regime. The colonial regime's struggle for survival is contrasted by Palestinians' continuous resistance efforts and aims of liberation and freedom. Following the escape of six Palestinian prisoners, celebrations were held in different locations throughout Palestine and elsewhere. Palestinian resistance groups and the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, have hailed the escape as heroic and a slap in the face of the Zionist occupier. One of the escape prisoners, Zakaria Zubaydi, who is the director of the Jenin Freedom Theater, wrote in a letter sent from prison in 2012, "I'm spiritually, physically, and mentally prepared to die for my freedom." Their escape from prison represents another act of successful liberation and strengthens the perspective that the colonial prison system will eventually be abolished, and in fact, the colonial regime also will collapse. Palestinian Islamic resistance movement Hamas has decried the reprisal measures adopted by the Israeli authorities against Palestinian captives following the escape of inmates from the high-security Israeli jail. In a statement on Wednesday, 8th of September, Hamas warned against the continuation of the repressive and retaliatory Israeli measures against Palestinian prisoners, holding the Tel Aviv regime responsible for consequences of these dangerous policies. Hamas hailed the prisoners' success in grabbing their freedom, describing the move as a courageous and heroic resistance incident and inspiring all freedom seekers throughout the world. Hamas also urged international organizations and human rights groups to stop the Israeli violations against Palestinian rights and the rights of Palestinian prisoners. The escape of inmates from the Zionist regime's high-security jail was the biggest Palestinian escape from an Israeli prison since 1987, when six members of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement broke out of a heavily guarded jail in the Gaza Strip. After the escape of the six inmates, the Israeli regime adopted collective punitive measures against the Palestinian prisoners. The punitive measures include moving tens of detainees to solitary confinement, preventing inmates from going to the prison yard, banning prisoners from meeting their families, and closing the canteens. Israeli military forces on Wednesday, 8th of September, launched raids in several prisons, including Al-Naqab and Rimon. In reaction to the escalating crackdown, Palestinian prisoners set fire to seven cells in Section 6 of the Al-Naqab prison. The Palestinian Information Center said the prison's authority moved all the captives from Section 6 to an undisclosed site. Israeli special forces also raided Sections 1, 4, 5, and 7 in Rimon prison and moved prisoners affiliated with the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement to different sections of the prison. The crackdown pushed the detainees to set several prison cells ablaze, particularly in Sections 4 and 5. Lebanon's Al-Mayadeen television network also reported that Israeli forces attacked Palestinian prisoners in Majdo prison. The Asra media office said the confrontation between Israel's prison authorities and the detainees was at a dangerous stage. The Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs said Israel's brutal attack on the Palestinian prisoners and the detention of relatives of prisoners aimed to cover up its failure and defeat against the Palestinian captives' firm will, urging the international community to put an end to the Israeli craziness. It also warned that the crackdown would ignite all arenas inside and outside of the prisons. The crackdown also sparked protests in the occupied West Bank. Human rights organizations say the Israeli regime violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the 4th Geneva Convention. There are reportedly more than 7,000 Palestinians held behind Israeli jails. Hundreds of Palestinian inmates have been apparently incarcerated under the practice of administrative detention.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Midnight, April 1st, 2015. The thunder of warplanes, accompanied by massive explosions, woke the children of Yemen. Saudi Arabia had initiated a war against Yemen, which, as claimed by the Saudi ambassador to Washington, Adel Al-Jubeir, sought to re-establish the legitimacy of deposed Yemeni president Abdrabu Mansour Hadi, and also to prevent the Ansarullah movement from dominating the Arab Peninsula country. The sudden invasion, which took place after receiving a green light from the United States and Britain, was the most visible and blatant instance of the Saudi regime's interference in the fate of the Yemeni people over recent years. An overt war waged after al-Saud's ever duplicitous goals and policies had been met with defeat. But what had taken place within Yemen's political environment that had forced foreign powers to undertake all but open military invasion to change the balance of power in Yemen and secure their aims? How had Ansarullah transformed from a small group to such power that Saudi Arabia contravened international law, acting preemptively to preserve the interests of itself
as well as those of its Persian Gulf allies. These questions can be answered with reference to a decade of tension in Yemen's political atmosphere, which featured barbaric acts such as the Sixfold Wars, which the incumbent government unleashed upon the Ansarullah, the consequence of which gave Ansarullah greater sophistication and experience by the day. This chronicle dates back some 20 years.
The Heart of Agate, Part 1.
On May 22, 1990, the Republic of Yemen was born out of the union between North and South Yemen, and Ali Abdullah Saleh, the president of the former country, was officially sworn in as the new nation's head of state. However, his discriminatory policies led to discontent among the people and leaders of the South, as well as numerous tensions and crises, eventually causing a civil war in 1994. The war, which is viewed by some as a war of unification and by others as a war of separation, went on for 2 months. During the war, the central government massacred the people of the South and destroyed the area's facilities and infrastructures, enjoying the jurisprudential and spiritual support of Yemen's Muslim Brotherhood, also known as the Reform Movement, and having received the requisite go-aheads and fatwas of the muftis affiliated to the Brotherhood to accuse the Southerners of apostasy. Soon after, on July 7, 1994, Saleh's government conquered Aden, defeating the movement of the South, forcing its leaders to flee.
It was then that the Northerners started establishing dominance over the Southerners. They saw it fit to gain dominance over everything, and Ali Abdullah Saleh managed to fully demolish the South and completely expand his control there.
Saleh embarked on many things. He assumed control of many power centers and spent a lot of money on them.
Of course, these things were not Saleh's doing alone. These were done by the coalition of politicians from his family in Sanhan and Abdullah ibn Hussein al-Ahmaz's family in Hashid.
Saudi Arabia's interference in Yemen continued in a direct manner. For instance, it was Saudi Arabia which always supported Ali Mohsen al-Ahmar, and it was the kingdom which helped him rise to his military authority.
Having wearied their inroads and after attaining control over the situation, they, especially al-Ahmar, were seeking to become the main puppeteers in Yemen.
Wealth was drawn around these people and the hypocrites around them, and the country turned into an area of ransacking and plunder.
And following Saleh's victory, he was faced with the demand to form a national unity government. The formation of such government would appease the losers of the war. The winners, however, rejected the proposal.
One of those severely insisting upon national unity was Sayyid Badruddin al-Houthi, the leader of Zaydi Houthis,
who was a great erudite belonging to the city of Houthi, south of the Saada Governorate. He is one of the pillars of the Zaydi sect.
Sayyid Badruddin is one of the Zaydi sect's prominent scholars and jurisprudents. He's also the father of Sayyid Hussein al-Houthi, and the current leader of the Houthi movement is Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi.
And they conspired against the brothers, whom they considered to be their opponents and real enemies. Though those brothers were the followers of the House of Muhammad, the Zaydi sect, and the noble people from the Fals, and much oppression and torture was brought about.
It had been going on for a while that some of those around Saleh, who had supported him in the war, were throwing tantrums. They were subjects of the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood, and this was an element which was a potential threat to Saleh's government in the long run. From Saleh's perspective, Zaydis were the only people whom he could pit against the Brotherhood, should he see fit.
And since Saleh knew this fact, he resorted to the divide-and-rule policy, which was being used by Britain at the time. He called the policy dancing on the heads of snakes, through which he would support one side against the other, and in most cases, support both of the sides.
In 1993, the Zaydis, who included a group of scholars, among whom were Sayyid Majduddin Muhammad al-Mu'ayyidi and Sayyid Badruddin al-Houthi, and who mostly resided in the Sa'dar Governorate, created the Al-Haq Islamic Party. It is clear that Saleh's policy at the time was to accommodate developments of this type, and institutions like the Al-Haq Party were able to stand in the face of extremist and radical ideologies in Yemen, including Al-Qaeda. This was a plus for Saleh's government, which was under pressure from the United States to confront Al-Qaeda.
The party, however, roused the opposition on matters of religious emulation by embarking on innovation and being influenced by the revolution of Imam Khomeini. In other words, they mobilized, while those sources of emulation merely espoused jurisprudence, scholarship, and things of that nature.
Therefore, a rift came about between the conservatives and the open-minded. The former comprised the Zaidi scholars and the elder ones, while the latter was led by Muhammad Azan.
But for how long could this go on? There was need for a moderate point of view to converge the two lines of thought and prevent further division and unease. Hussein al-Houthi, a like-minded friend of Azan's, who maintained a moderate position, undertook to do this while engaging in political activity. Sayyid Hussein started to write and propagate his ideology, especially among the young generation.
Hussein al-Houthi was a parliamentarian, a strong personality who maintained innovative thoughts. He had a special charisma which awarded him popularity and fame among Zaydis, especially in Sa'da.
And Sayyid Badr al-Din al-Houthi maintained a moderate position which caused everyone to find solace in him.
And this made him similar to other notable personalities, great people and religious personages who undertook to promulgate ideology and educate people.
A time had come that oppression in Yemen had come to a head and the country was experiencing intellectual, economic and military invasion and war on its own soil.
After returning from Sudan, he tried to resolve the problems which had grown deeper between the open-minded and conservative movements.
He said, "This studying of yours is just for show. While you're thumbing through books, oppression has thrown its clutches over the country."
In his mind, the problem resided in divergence from the noble Quran. Hence, he started to invite people to return to the holy book.
With every policy that would be issued, he would circulate some Quranic verses and compare the meaning to the existing circumstances.
And then the ideology of revolution and change and refusal to accept the present circumstances was engendered in his mind.
Sayyid Hussein al-Houthi resided in Al-Maran in northern Yemen on a mountain that overlooked Saudi Arabia. He embarked upon contemplation as well as addressing and preparing the youth, who developed a strong admiration towards Sayyid and were influenced by him.
So, at that time, he created a group in Sa'da named Al-Shabab al-Mu'min and adopted a number of slogans as well as political and cultural inclinations. The movement is essentially a cultural one. In other words, it maintains a cultural plan of action and perspective for its activities and presence.
The movement rose up, devoted to the seeking of justice, and it rejected all foreign intervention as well as oppression, callousness, and tyranny.
He possessed an authoritative presence in Sa'da. This was alarming for the central government in Sana'a and Yemen's northern neighbor, Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia was the United States' main ally in the region, a fact that had made the kingdom a source of concern for Yemen's government. Saleh was being gradually pressured to act against the Zaydis. What he did, though, was to begin suppressing the main allies of the Saudis, namely the Salafis, instead of fighting the Zaydis.
Wow.
And after the events of 9/11, the relations between the US and Saudi Arabia became strained since most of the people who carried out the operation possessed Saudi passports. It was then that Saleh thought he could become the US's premier ally in the region.
Saleh tried to ally himself with the US in a coalition against terrorism.
Therefore, he speedily undertook to eradicate the Salafis, especially those who had returned from Afghanistan.
Then the time came when Saleh finally pit the Houthis against the Salafis. But things did not go according to his long-time plans. Instead of confronting and taking revenge on Wahhabis and Salafis, Hossein al-Houthi turned the confrontation into one against the United States.
He did so by declaring he would not accept that U.S. interrogators come and interrogate Yemeni civilians.
Bush started an international war on Islam. He called it war on terrorism. Sayyid Hussein, however, denounced it as a war on Islam.
And he said the U.S. was doing this on a global scale so that we may face a moral defeat and that the killing of Muslims would turn into an everyday matter. He said moral defeat was more dangerous than military defeat and therefore started to chant this slogan.
Therefore, Sayyid Hussein said he would alienate the people from the slogan of fear, and if the government became angry, he would ask them, why do you lose your temper over the US and Israel?
Accordingly, he sought to popularize moral slogans so we do not face moral defeat, and these slogans were aimed to counter that of Bush's, who deceptively said, anyone who is not with us is against us. Ali Abdullah Saleh came to the conclusion that this undertaking of Sayyid Hussein had robbed him of the opportunity to become the US's preferred ally in the region.
And he escalated oppression, tyranny, destruction, torture, and imprisonment.
On January 18, 2004, thousands of soldiers, backed by tens of aircraft, hundreds of tanks, cannons, and other heavy and semi-heavy military equipment, attacked the areas of El Nashur, El Saifi, Maran, and Zahyan in the Sadr Governorate. It was the government's first war on the Houthis, which lasted for 3 months.
The person who directed the wars against Zaidi Shias, or Al-Shabaab al-Mumen, was named Ali Mohsen al-Amar and was among those close to President Ali Abdullah Saleh. He, however, was inclined toward Wahhabism. Known to maintain such inclination, he received his orders from Saudi Arabia.
The civil war lasted for some time, and then Sayyid Hussein was martyred and his body was confiscated. The body was placed in one of the central prisons in Sana'a in order to be out of reach of his followers, so that his followers could not erect a tomb for him, and so that Sayyid, who was the leader of a movement, could not be paid tribute to.
However, prior to the fall of Maran, Sayyid Hussein had ordered Sayyid Abdullah Malik al-Houthi to be transferred from the area to another. He secretly knew of Abdul Malik's importance without divulging this to anyone else.
The death of Sayyid Hussein al-Houthi, the leader of the Zaydis, and many of his aides dissipated Saleh's and Ali Mohsen al-Ahmar's concerns regarding the situation in Sadr, especially in light of the fact that the movement had lost its leader.
The Al-Shabaab al-Mumen movement, however, did not go disband, but lived on thanks to the support of Hussein's father and martyr, Al-Amer Badr al-Din al-Houthi.
At the time, negotiations were underway between Ansar and the government. The talks were led by Sayyid Badr al-Din al-Houthi, who represented Ansarullah.
The government, though, did not live to its promises. Sayyid Badr al-Din consequently returned to the area of Al-Nashur.
Following Sayyid Hussein's martyrdom, all eyes turned towards Abdullah al-Ruzami, his former colleague in the House of Representatives, with no one even thinking of Abdul Malik. Abdullah al-Ruzami was residing in Al-Nashur, and thus Ansarullah members made their way to that area, gathering there.
The area of Al-Nashur is very small and surrounded by mountains on every side.
At the time, Sayyid Abdul Malik said it was a mistake for the Ansarullah to congregate in the area as it is too open and also it is close to a major garrison. He said that it was incumbent upon the movement to spread out and ordered each member to start operating independently in the area. Al-Ruzami disapproved of this idea.
Towards the end of January 2005, Abdullah Saleh waged his second war on the Houthis. On this occasion, Al-Ruzami was the leader of the Ansarullah movement's military wing and undertook to direct its defense. Despite the efforts and martyrdom of many of his brethren, this war too ended with the movement's defeat and his arrest on March 27, 2005. As their enemy closed in, Badruddin al-Houthi retreated through the impassable mountain range of Sadr together with his remaining fighters.
Some of these fighters would actually tie themselves up to force themselves to stand their ground, and there they would fight until they were murdered.
After this second war, leadership was passed down to Abdul Malik al-Houthi, who is now considered the leader of the Ansarullah.
Sayyid Abdul Malik departed for Matran, which is a strategic area geographically reinforced. On his departure, he was accompanied by a small number of people, but with time, others joined him, believing in his cause.
It was during this sojourn that people began to be drawn to Abdul Malik al-Houthi, the younger son of Sayyid Badruddin, despite there being an older brother named Yahya. Abdul Malik, born in 1979, in Sadr Governorate, rose to a leadership rank of Shabab al-Mu'min, owing to his personal characteristic.
Once his popularity was apparent, Abdul Malik started to preach some ideological themes to initiate people with Sayyid Hussein's ways.
He then dispatched youth to Sana'a to spread his ideology. These emissaries were met by the brutality of security forces and thrown into security, political prisons, or other kinds of prisons.
The government commanded them to stay in the mountains and even offered to pay them to do this. But Sayyid Abdul Malik rejected these demands, and hence a third war began, which was the beginning of victories.
It could be interpreted from the measures the government implemented during this third war that it sought to utterly annihilate the movement.
Meetings took place between Saudi Arabia and the US over how to steer the war towards achieving the total eradication of the Houthi movement once and for all. Houthis were bombarded with false accusations and subjected to a massive propaganda campaign.
And when the third war started, most all of the fighters followed the lead of Sayyid Abdul Malik.
The third war took place in March 2006 under the command of Ali Mohsen al-Ahmar. But this time it was the Houthis that won, delivering a heavy toll upon the aggressors. The victory further affirmed the position of Abdul Malik and the Houthis as heroes among the people, while causing deeper concern for the Yemeni government and consequently the Saudis. Saleh put on a public face, but in secret he was planning vengeance.
Then, they released all the prisoners as part of their plan to prepare themselves for a fourth war, which was indeed a war of eradication. Since it was not tactful to kill 800 inmates whilst incarcerated, they released them so they could be killed on the battlefield. Then commencement of the fourth war was violated. Just imagine a sudden onslaught of aggression directed at a single location, with all the weaponry in their position, with around-the-clock attacks. But by the grace of God the Almighty, the defenders withstood this aggression and claimed victory. Warfare ended, leaving the government in defeat and weakened.
The victors were Ansarullah. The win enabled the group to capitalize on their position and on their wartime experience to negotiate an agreement with the government. But there was a fifth war, and it was during this that the Ansarullah movement increased their acclaim, managing to free Al-Maran and forcing the government to withdraw from the area as well as many other areas in Sa'da.
The fifth war began in March 2008,
and ended in January the following year with a resounding victory for the Houthis. Their momentum led to a significant growth in awareness of the people who were all invited to become acquainted with the Al-Shabaab al-Mu'min's movement, thereafter identified as Ansar Allah.
The movement grew and spread beyond Sa'adah governorate into Hajar, Al-Jawf, and Amran, capturing greater influence in other governorates and expanding remarkably quickly.
And the fighters' faith in Sayyid Abdul Malik's ability to direct the group grew at every stage.
Each time the aggressors started their ways, the Yemeni youth became more resistant, more determined. This was very noticeable following the Third War, the Fourth and Fifth Wars. We cannot predict such a phenomenon would occur.
Then there came a sixth war between the government and Ansarullah, with Saudi Arabia and the U.S. ready to prop up the government to join in. Eventually, 28 countries became involved in this war.
Saudi Arabia had supported the Yemeni government in all of its previous wars on Ansarullah. In the sixth one, the Wahhabi kingdom used their own fighters in direct confrontations.
And they sought to enter Sa'adah governorate with military forces in an attempt to destroy outright the Al-Shabaab al-Mu'min movement.
Saudi Arabia entered the war directly, decimating suburbs, dropping bombs from their planes, from their American aircrafts.
More than 20,000 houses were destroyed and thousands of people were killed, particularly among the civilians, women, children, and the elderly. In fact, they intentionally destroyed homes while the people were still inside. And in some cases, these civilians lived outside the confrontation zone in peaceful residential areas which did not have